From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Maria Sharapova was calm and blunt last week, but the news was big. She had tested positive for the recently banned drug meldonium, that is, for doping. She said she hadn't gotten the memo banning meldonium, that she had used it for medical reasons, but it's doping, and now maybe a doping crisis, as many others are testing positive in skating, wrestling, track and field, more. This hour On Point, Maria Sharapova, and the question at the cutting edge of doping, where is the line between medical treatment and cheating? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this your world? Where do you draw the line? What's fair? What's not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, a top NFL official has for the first time acknowledged a link between football-related head trauma and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We'll look at how this could impact the sport. But first to Sharapova and doping. Here she was in Los Angeles last Monday, talking about how she had failed the drug test for the Australian Open, announcing she'd been notified of this by the International Tennis Federation.
A few days ago, I received a letter from the ITF that I had failed a drug test at the Australian Open. I did fail the test, and I take full responsibility for it.
And the next thing you know, we're reading about 60, 80, 100, maybe more than 100, also testing positive for meldonium. Joining me now via Skype from Newburyport, Massachusetts, is Christopher Clary, chief sports correspondent for the New York Times, covering tennis and the Olympic Games. He's also a regular sports columnist for the International New York Times. Christopher Clary, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So first we read you on Sharapova, and then within days, you got headlines talking about a doping crisis and very large numbers of athletes testing positive, I guess, for meldonium. What's going on?
You know, that's still a little unclear at this point, Tom. I think the situation is evolving quickly. We're at 100 positive tests since January 1st. So you're talking about a 10-week period. That is a great number, a large number of tests for that short a period of time.
I mean, we're talking long-distance runners and biathletes, cyclists, ice dancer, wrestler. Is it because this was just declared a banned drug at the first of this year, I guess, and so it's still in their system?
There are a few different explanations possible. I think one thing is clear. What the high numbers show is that a lot of athletes were using this before, probably a lot more than would normally be taking a drug that goes onto the banned list. It also shows that potentially, and we brought this up in some of the stories this week, you know, the Russian Anti-Doping Federation has pretty much been in meltdown for the last few months. Has been suspended and then reconstituted. There may have been an issue of communication that was happening during the period when this drug was put on the list, because normally they're put on well in advance and athlete community is notified worldwide. WADA officials have said that was not a factor, but you talk to some Russian officials and they say that there was some breakdowns in the communication chain that made it harder for their athletes to be notified. Clearly, this is not all about athletes not realizing the drug's on the list, but these numbers would suggest something else was going on, too.
But it leaves everybody wondering what's okay here and what's not. This meldonium, a drug developed in Latvia for heart conditions, we're told. The positive effect for an athlete, I guess, it would increase the oxygen flow to the muscles. But really, everybody's got heart conditions over there? Doubt it. Here was Andy Murray, ranked currently number two in the world in men's singles. He had a press conference at a conference on Saturday in California. You may have heard this, Christopher. He reacted to the news that dozens, scores of athletes had tested positive for meldonium.
I read that 55 athletes have failed tests for that substance since January the 1st. So, you know, it's you just don't expect sort of high-level athletes at the top of many different sports to have heart conditions.
Yeah, a little tongue-in-cheek there from Andy Murray. No, you certainly don't. Everybody to expect to have them. Maybe the Sharapova story is illustrative of what's going on here. Take us back, Christopher, to what she said and what she is now asserting about why and how she started using this, how long she used meldonium, for what purpose.
Well, she said that she began using it 10 years ago. At the recommendation of a family doctor, and she used it for a variety of medical conditions, including pre-diabetes, which was even more urgent in her case, I guess, because she had a family history of diabetes. Also because she was falling ill frequently. also an issue with magnesium deficiency. A lot of these suggestions on her part have been contested in recent days by American and European doctors, but there's a lot of material on this substance in Russian, and it was developed in Latvia and is pretty prominent in the eastern part of Europe in terms of usage. You don't need a prescription to get it in Russia. It can be bought quite cheaply, and it's a drug that's not allowed for sale here by the FDA or in the European Union. So really a bit of a cultural contrast there as well. But Maria said she took the drug for 10 years, and then there's a process with WADA where when a drug is put on its banned list, it goes basically under surveillance for a year, and it goes on their monitoring list. And Meldonium was put on that list for the year 2015. And Maria said she was never aware of that process either. And then when the drug went on the list, basically a drug that had been allowed, had been legal for all that period of time, beginning January 1, 2016, it was now banned. And her test came during the Australian Open. I think it was January 25th or January 26th. So in that 25-day period that it was illegal, she tested positive. And so her argument's going to be that she was taking it for medical reasons all along, nothing changed, simply missed the memo. But that ability she'll have to prove that it was really being used for medical reasons is going to be critical, I think, to her case in terms of the length of suspension she'll end up with.
We're going to look at that line between medical use, asserted anyway, and just what ends up being doping. She says she got the email about this but didn't click on the link. And again, here she was last week in Los Angeles accepting response, saying it was a mistake.
I take great responsibility and professionalism in my job every single day, and I made a huge mistake, and I've let my fans down. I've let the sport down that I've been playing since the age of four that I love so deeply.
Some people bought it. Some people didn't. Serena Williams said Sharapova showed courage by owning up to her failed drug test.
As Maria said, she's ready to take full responsibility, and I think that showed a lot of courage and a lot of heart. And I think she's always showed courage and heart in everything that she's done, and this is no different.
But others looked at this and said, wait a minute, this is about a medical condition over time. At WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, former head there, Dick Pound, said her explanation that she'd used it for 10 years for therapeutic treatment just doesn't hold up.
The use of this product for therapeutic purposes is not a long term. You use it for a single intervention of weeks or a couple of months maybe, but not for 10 years in a row.
Pretty tough on it, Dick Pound. They're talking with The Guardian here with ITV News on March 9th, saying maybe she was hoping she could get away with it.
She was either recklessly indifferent to what messages she was getting from WADA and from the ATP, or she did it deliberately and thought maybe I'll get away with it.
Christopher Clary, chief sports correspondent for the New York Times, is with us. And Christopher, lots of callers for you. Sean in Fremont, Nebraska. Sean, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I would compare the meldonium to the EPO crisis, which also increases oxygen supply to your muscles. This was...
You mean in bicycling?
Bicycling. Mm-hmm. And that also increases oxygen to your muscles. So I think that, you know, Sharapova should have known about this as that type of problem. So I would say that it's definitely a banned substance.
Well, I mean, we know it's banned now, but it wasn't banned before. She says openly that she was using it for 10 years. You've got scores, maybe over 100, many of them Russian, apparently using it, and no doubt using it before it was formally banned. How do you feel about that, Sean? Are you a bicycling guy? What about a drug that increases oxygen flow? Should that be doping? Should they be in trouble?
Yeah, I think it should be doping because it's mimicking high altitude, which increases the number of blood cells in your body. So, I mean, that should definitely be not allowed as a banned substance. I think Maria should have known about that. I think using it for pre-diabetes is ridiculous.
Sean, I appreciate your call. Christopher, what about comparing this to the doping scandals we've seen in bicycling?
Well, I think the EPO scandal, a long-running issue with that, from my understanding, was a lot clearer, perhaps, the science, and over a longer period of time. Also, a life-threatening issue at times if it was abused. Stories of athletes getting up in the middle of the night, cyclists trying to keep their blood from thickening too much. They might end up, dying overnight. There were some deaths associated with it as well, with its abuse. I'm not sure we're there with this. My question is, I'd like to see more and more studies about what WADA used as the basis for banning this drug. Clearly, they felt strongly about it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made the move after a year of surveillance. There hasn't been a lot published yet to show it. A lot of the literature on this drug was in Russian. The feeling is that it energizes the cell's powerhouse, the mitochondria. That's what I was told by a sports scientist this week. It's one of the reasons why it was banned. But the issue is going to really come up a lot in this next several months as these cases that are positive tests are adjudicated in the sports courts. People are going to try to prove that it was banned without enough sufficient cause, and there's going to be a lot of debate about that.
But we've got this. We've got the Olympics coming up. Of course, there was this German documentary by Hans-Joachim Seppelt saying 17% of Russian athletes tested were found to have meldonium in their system. Are we headed for a juiced Olympics, Christopher?
Going to be a big issue, and I think the more that comes out to show a real strong link to performance enhancement with this drug, the worse this is going to get. You also could argue those numbers are very high, 17%. Also, another study that came out about last year's European Games that showed 600 out of 6,000 athletes were using the drug, so it's obviously very prevalent. That's a big issue.
It just feels weird to have such wide usage and then suddenly it's called doping, and pretty soon for the lay observer of sports, you're wondering what's doping and what's not.
Well, I agree. It's a big, big issue. And the issue you can also ask about is that there are things that are on the market already that athletes are using. Let's talk about things that we're all using, like caffeine, which in large quantities has been proven to be performance enhancing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Maria Sharapova, her drug meldonium, and the new cutting edge of sports doping, looking here for the line between legitimate medical treatment and cheating. Christopher Clary is with us. He is chief sports correspondent for the New York Times, focuses on tennis and the Olympic Games. Of course, Rio is coming up. People wondering what these enormous numbers that have come out since before and especially since Sharapova's announcement. Might we have a juiced Olympics on the way, or at least a big debate about it? You can join us this hour. Were you shocked to hear Maria Sharapova saying, yeah, I did it, sorry? Are you really shocked anymore to hear of doping at top levels in sports? What is doping, anyway? To you, with all the supplements and therapies and stuff out there, what's doping? Where's the line? Here she was again in L.A., Sharapova saying her doctor prescribed this for her 10 years ago for medical treatment. Meldonium was put on the WADA's, the World Anti-Doping Association's banned substances list at the first of this year.
I was given this medicine by my doctor for several health issues that I was having back in 2006. I was getting sick a lot. I was getting the flu every couple of months. I had irregular EKG results. As well as indications of diabetes.
All kinds of responses to this, receptions for this. You heard Serena Williams pretty accommodating, but last week we had tennis star Novak Djokovic reacting to the news of Sharapova's positive test for meldonium. He called Sharapova brave, but...
In the sport in general, there is a conviction with many athletes that, maybe medications and certain substances can, make you feel healthy or feel better. I don't believe in that kind of short-term process. I believe in long-term balance and harmonious health and well-being.
And everybody's thinking now about what the penalty should be. She's 28, turning 29 soon. Last Thursday, 14-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal told reporters, if you break the rules, you got to face the consequences.
The rules are like this, and it's fair, and now she must pay for it.
Of course, even there it gets murky. Earlier that week, the former French Minister for Health and Sport publicly accused Nadal himself of doping in 2012. He's come back and said he's a completely clean guy. What penalties are being contemplated for Sharapova at this point, Christopher?
Well, if they can prove there was intent to cheat, intentional use of the substance, which was banned in this class, it could be up to 4 years. if her lawyers and Maria can prove that it was inadvertence on her part, and obviously arguing the fact that she wasn't aware it had changed status would be part of that, then it would be up to 2 years. And most experts I've talked to in the last week or so who have experience in these kind of tests and cases would say that we're looking at probably a 0 to 2 year ban. Hard to imagine she won't get some sort of ban. So maybe 1 to 2 years is probably the most common response I've heard from lawyers and attorneys who deal with this.
Of course, I mean, all kinds of reactions. Have her sponsors, she was making something like $30 million a year, Nike and Porsche, have they pulled away or just paused in their relationship?
They have put her at several arm's length, is the way I would put it. Definitely, Tom, there's a lot of pullback. Just today, the UN Development Agency, one of a humanitarian group that she's been working with, suspended her connection with them as well as a goodwill ambassador. So it's ranging from, you know, big money contracts like Nike, which have been suspended for the moment, to things like that, which are more symbolic, which I know has a lot of meaning to her personally, and that has been suspended as well. So the reaction commercially has been quite swift, although there has been one of her sponsors, Head, that came out and supported her fully and actually made suggestions to WADA about better ways to run their program. So it's been quite a wide range of response.
We saw that, I think, from your reporting, the head of Head, the racket company, she's been with them since 2011, Johan Elijsch. The CEO there committed to Sharapova and said, what would the right penalty be? She should teach kids tennis for 3 months, community service. He said, no big deal here. We're going to look at that. Adam in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just retired at the end of last season from a 13-year career as a professional cyclist.
Okay.
I came up through the same era of Lance Armstrong, George Hincapie, Tyler Hamilton, those guys are all my peers.
Lots of doping out there in those years, yeah.
Yeah, and I took a different path and had what you might describe as a slightly less lucrative career as a result of that, just choosing to race clean and make that part of, you know, how I wanted to do the sport.
Respect to you, Adam.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. The story here is just one that we've heard over and over again. The stakes are so high and the athletes are so intelligent and well-educated. She certainly made a mistake in maybe not being aware that it had been added to the list, which is a stupid mistake to make when it had been on the monitored list for a year. Every athlete, professional athlete and amateur athlete who's subject to WADA or USADA standards knows where that information is, how to find it, how to review it. There are iPhone apps that help you research very quickly what's on the list and what's not on the list, what's legal in competition, out of competition. So mistakes get made, but there's no mistake as to why she might have been taking that substance in the first place. Like, that story doesn't match up. It's not something that she wouldn't be taking unless she saw, hey, here's a substance that will give me some advantage that's not currently banned. And that's, I think, the real explanation for why she was taking it for as long as she was.
So you're not buying the legitimate medical therapeutic use over 10 years. You see her looking for an advantage. And is the line clear to you, Adam?
It is for me, but I set my line in a different place maybe than just where the rules set it. For me, there's a difference for sure between anti-aging medication, medicine you take to repair your health, as opposed to drugs that you take to improve your recovery. And I think that's something that people don't always understand about doping in strength or endurance sports. It's not just, you know, we're not taking stimulants. Those athletes aren't taking stimulants. It's what you're seeing in sport is recovery drugs so that you can train, recover sooner, train harder, and reach a higher level. No one's doping and sitting on the couch afterwards. Everybody's
right,
going out and doing harder and harder workouts. And that's clearly what the case is here. I think the anti-aging community in particular is, that's why you're seeing more and more masters age doping infractions, is because they're finally going after those athletes as well.
So you're saying really it's juicing for improved recovery, so you're ready to go out and hit it again strong more quickly.
Yeah, that's right. Instead of saying, I'm sick, maybe I shouldn't be competing. If you need to take medication to compete, then you should stay home.
But there we are. I mean, that is now doping. I mean, Christopher, that's where the line is now, right? If you I guess, as Adam and others say, if you're enhancing your bounce back with a drug, Is that where they WADA comes in and says, nope, sorry?
I think that's a big reason why this was banned after such a long period of time, Tom. And very, very good sort of story there from Adam about his own tale of in the sport. But I think the fact of it is they saw such big numbers in their studies the last couple of years of athletes using this that there's no way they were all using it for medical reasons. That was apparent. And this kind of widespread usage when you're taking a pharmaceutical and using it to basically boost your recovery, help your heart rate, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
At least when you see it in that kind of widespread numbers, that was the reason I think why they made the move they did when they made it. And I think I personally agree with Adam. I think that when you get to that point, there's a real issue when you have a substance that's banned in most of the world, most of the developed world. It's being used by others in a non-pharmaceutical situation, perhaps in Russia, but nonetheless, when it's being used that way, that to me is a big alarm bell going off. And, but the only issue I'd bring up real quickly is just that there are things that we all use in our daily life, and a lot of athletes use. I know it's quite prominent in many sports. Just take caffeine, for example, which is also on WADA's monitored list this year, which is quite interesting. But caffeine was banned at one time in certain dosages. Now there's no restriction. And I know that a lot of athletes, given the opportunity, knowing that it does have performance-enhancing qualities, are using caffeine in large quantities before performances, before events. So this issue is, when you get into it, there's a lot of different dimensions to it.
A lot of ambiguity, but athletes, pay attention. Caffeine itself on the monitoring list now. Of course, Sharapova saying last week that she didn't know about this. She didn't click on a link from in an email from WADA with a list of banned substances. Here she was.
I received a letter on December 22nd from WADA, an email with the changes happening for next year, as well as reporting your whereabouts, and a link to a button where you can press to see the prohibited items for 2016, and I did not look at that list.
Of course, Dick Pound, the former head of the World Anti-Doping Agency, saying, look, if you're making $30 million a year off your tennis life, you better pay attention.
The Tennis Association issued several warnings, none of which she apparently read. So I'm sorry, if you're running a $30 million a year sole enterprise, you better make sure that the basis for that commercial success, if nothing else, remains unassailable.
Margaret in Winchester, Massachusetts. Margaret, you're on.
I just wanted to, I think maybe Adam has answered my question, but these substances that are on a monitored list for a year prior to them going on to a...
prohibited list, yep.
Prohibited list, you know, because she's going to be taking tests before every tournament that she plays. So, I mean, that certainly must have shown up at some point, you know, in her blood work. So, I don't know, maybe she needed a more personal warning than that, but... you know, it seems like it would. I wouldn't want to be accused of having a gotcha moment. You know, when, you know, she must have. You know, I think they should definitely make sure that she's warned well enough. Thank you, and I can take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Margaret. Christopher, how about it? Wouldn't this? Maybe they should have called her. They had her blood work. Maybe they should have let her know. Margaret wonders if there's a gotcha element here.
It's a very good question and a very good point. And I've asked that question a number of times this week, different people. Answers vary. One thing that's clear is that if you are taking a substance like that that's on the watch list, if you want to call it that, there's no reporting of that to the authorities that would sanction and deal with these athletes. What they do is they survey its use, but they don't have it as part of official blood tests or urine tests, as far as I understand, when it comes back. So there would be tough for them to reach out to an athlete individually. But there are some cases I know in the past, for example, with when marijuana was banned and there were traces of it in people's samples, there was some communication back and forth before it went on the banned list to athletes saying that they should be aware of the situation going forward when this does go on the list. So I think one of the takeaways from this last couple of weeks is that there could be improvements made to the system. But I think ultimately, with a three-month lead time, considering how digitally savvy most of the elite athletes in this world are today, I think that the onus still has to be on the athletes, but there could be improvements made to communication. I think that's clear.
Christopher Clary, chief sports correspondent with the New York Times. Please stand by. I want to turn to Austin, Texas now, and John Huberman. He's sports and doping historian at the University of Texas, Austin. He's written a lot about sports, doping, the whole nexus there. John Huberman in Austin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
What do you make of this story? Has Maria Sharapova acted in a way that deserves a big penalty?
I am very skeptical about her story for a number of reasons. First of all, as Dick Pound pointed out, the claimed 10-year duration of the therapy, it's supposed to be a much more shorter and intermittent therapy. And by the way, there are better drugs for diabetes. There are better drugs for the irregular EKG she mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's not as if she were living in Latvia or Russia. She's been in the United States for the past 21 years. And one effect of this story is to prompt the question, what is the quality of the medical advice that she has been getting as a $30 million a year athlete? And by the way, she makes more in a year than WADA operates on in a year.
Wow. Well, then the doping agency gets it. So, but why do you ask that question? I mean, are you presuming that she thought that this was real medical advice about her irregular EKG? 10 seconds ago, you were saying you don't believe that story.
No, I don't believe the story. Another issue is where and how was she getting the drug? There are Federal Drug Administration import regulations on drugs. This is not approved by the FDA. The lawyer claims that she has been handling it in compliance with FDA rules. I would like to see one piece of evidence that is the case.
I mean, she's Russian, but has lived here since she was 7. In Russia, you can buy it over the counter, I think. Don't even need a prescription, but not here, I guess you're saying, John.
That's correct.
There's just too much
doubt that she has created through the statements she made at this preemptive PR press conference she held.
Does that suggest to you medical doctors who are playing really fast and loose with the truth here about what they're up to?
There are many medical doctors in this country who play fast and loose with doping drugs, the so-called low-T commercial testosterone industry has taken off over the past 10 or 15 years. There's a lot of...
You mean aiming that at athletes for improved performance?
Aiming it at an enormous audience, a tiny sliver of which is elite athletes. Okay. The aging male is the primary target for the testosterone marketing that we've been seeing over the past 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. And what about this line between medical therapy and doping? Is it clear? Should it be? Can it be?
I don't think so. It's important to understand that all of the classic sports doping drugs, including anabolic steroids, human growth hormone, and the EPO blood-boosting drug, all of these drugs were created for legitimate medical reasons. And what happens, as in the case of meldonium, which is purportedly a legitimate medical drug, is that athletes are hungry for news about any new drug that might possibly help them. And, you know, the question of whether meldonium works or not, hardly any of these drugs have been scientifically demonstrated to work. And it's interesting to note that Dr. Ivar Kalvins, the Latvian inventor of this stuff, according to the news reports I've seen, has been talking out of both sides of his mouth. In one source, he's saying that the hubbub over Sharapova's use of the drug is some sort of a conspiracy. You know, it's to blacken his reputation. Newsweek Europe is reporting that Kalvins is a pharmacological entrepreneur who pushes meldonium as a drug that is potentially beneficial to athletes.
Ultimately, what's the problem here? Is it fairness in competition? Is it the athlete's health, I should say?
The athlete's health, of course, is an issue, but high-performance athletes are famously willing to risk their health in order to get results. I think that the inescapable sort of bottom line here is intention. Is the drug being used for a legitimate medical purpose, or is the intention to boost performance?
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Maria Sharapova, her drug Meldonium, and the new, cutting edge of sports doping, looking for the line between legitimate medical treatment and cheating, or some might say whether there should be a line. Christopher Clary is with us, chief sports correspondent for the New York Times. John Hoberman is with us from the University of Texas at Austin. He's all over this subject and its long history. We're going to talk in a moment about the NFL acknowledging a high official in the NFL for the first time the connection between football and traumatic brain injury. But first, we want to work through a little more of this doping issue. All kinds of angles online and people responding. Sam says, I say let them dope, and others want to come down hard. Brian joins us from Canton, Ohio. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just to speak a little bit on the line, it's definitely blurry as far as medical versus performance enhancing goes. In my opinion, the athletes that play in these leagues or for a players union or on a specific circuit,
yeah,
or whatever, they completely have the right to go to their personal doctor for diagnosis and prescriptions and things like that. But when a banned substance comes up, or even one on a monitor list comes up, I feel like the athlete should have their condition confirmed with a league-sanctioned doctor to kind of paint a picture. Yeah, you have this problem. Here's your prescription. Or wait a minute. This is totally out of line. You don't need to be on this.
You mean to assess whether or not it's a legitimate medical condition they're being treated for? Do you see a gray area here? Do you see a difficulty in deciding what should be legit, what's legit and what's doping?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, in Sharapova's case, she said she's been on this drug for 10 years. Now, do I believe that she has a legitimate medical excuse to be on it? Not really, but if she had gone to a sanctioned doctor...
Yeah. Still, we might not be debating it now, but then everybody's kind of looking at 10 years and saying, really? But, okay, so go to the doctor and get the sticker on there. Of course, as John Hoberman says, you get doctors willing to say and do lots of things here. Let me get one more. Jeremy in West Hartford, Connecticut. Jeremy, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just have a bit of a controversial stand on this. I think when it comes to doping or performance enhancing, I think that you need to let the athletes go ahead and do it. And I'll say this for two reasons. Number one, the biggest complaint that you hear is that it gives athletes an unfair advantage. And what I would respond to that is that there's no such thing as a level playing field when it comes to genetics. You or I probably don't have the same genetic or biological gifts which allow Kobe Bryant to be Kobe Bryant, right?
Hey, in my mind, I'm Kobe.
All right, well, good for you, Tom. There you go. More power to you. But also, on another standpoint, I just think that when you look at athletes that perform at this high level, high level, especially when they're making money like $30 million a year, there's just such an incentive to use these drugs that it really can't be curbed. In fact, there was a study based out of Australia, I believe, a few years ago, where a bunch of Olympic athletes were questioned and surveyed, and they were asked, if you were given a drug that would allow you to win an Olympic gold medal, but would kill you within the next 5 years, would you take it? And overwhelmingly, over 50% of those athletes said, yes, I would. And that study was even replicated a little bit later. And again, over 50% of those athletes said, yes, I would take that drug.
And you say, let them have it. People aren't born all the same anyway. Let me pick that up, Jeremy. I appreciate your call. Norman Foss, Dr. Norman Foss joins us right now from Madison, Wisconsin, director of the bioethics program at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Dr. Foss, Norman Foss, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're kind of on board with Jeremy. You said You have said your position is let everybody use a drug like Meldonium. You know, don't ban things that work for athletes, and don't even call it doping. It's pejorative. What's the why let everybody have, I guess, sort of whatever? Is that what you're saying?
The hypocrisy here is astonishing, Tom. I feel like I'm listening to Inspector Renault, who's shocked that there's gambling going on. Everybody is shocked that athletes are using performance-enhancing substances. They've been doing it since the beginning of time. All athletes do it. All your listeners use performance-enhancing substances, whether it's coffee in the morning or alcohol at night or Viagra on the weekend. Adam, the cyclist, is concerned about Maria Sharapova taking a drug to improve oxygen delivery to her tissues. If he would watch any NFL or college football game, he'd see everybody on the sidelines inhaling oxygen to improve oxygen delivery to their tissues. It's a drug. It's okay. Your cyclist, Adam, who's concerned about EPO use, it's perfectly legal and considered ethical for him or anyone else to train at altitude and jack up his hemoglobin. It's perfectly okay to sleep in a low-oxygen chamber and jack up your hemoglobin. But somehow when you do it by injecting EPO or injecting your own blood, which is exactly the same way that you do it, by sleeping at altitude, everyone gets all hot and bothered.
Yeah, but if we say anything goes, then the next thing you know, you turn the Olympics on, and it looks like a freak show. Everybody's pumped up on, looks like, you know, world wrestling, and sort of monstrous transformer bodies. God knows what chemicals they could pump in there. I mean, doesn't it take us to a freak show place if we just throw away all the restraints?
Well, if by freak show you mean athletes using performance-enhancing substances, then it is a freak show, because all of them are using something. All long-distance runners and cyclists trained at altitude to jack up their hemoglobins. It's unnatural. If you want to call that a freak, so be it. But it's widely accepted, and there's nothing illegal about it.
John Hoberman, how about it? Take the restraints off. It's hypocritical. Let people do whatever they want to do.
Well, I've been listening to Dr. Foss' arguments for almost 30 years since the Ben Johnson scandal, and I have been researching and publishing on doping for that long, and I simply do not accept his position for
Why?
A number of reasons. Mm-hmm. For one thing, he is ignoring a number of medical hazards. People are not going to get strokes and heart attacks by boosting their EPO by cycling at altitude, but if they take too much EPO, they will.
Mm-hmm.
A second reason is that we do not want to recruit and legitimize an expanded cohort of doping doctors. When you actually look at the international collection of doping doctors we know about, what you see are people who are addicted to lying, dishonesty, and unethical medical risk-taking.
So legalize it, and then everybody's straight, I guess.
That is an illusion. The idea that medically supervised doping creates a level playing field is simply not true for two reasons. First of all, different human beings have different drug receptors, and so they're not all going to benefit equally from the administration of a drug. The more important part is that the athletes who are willing to violate the current rules are going to be just as willing to violate a revised set of rules. So you legalize, and what you do is you just set off a new doping arms race departing from a higher dose level.
Dr. Faust, what would it look like, Dr. Faust, if we went to your world? No boundaries.
Well, you'd have a safer world, because if the drugs were available over the counter instead of under the counter, you wouldn't have people going to offshore labs and Balco labs. You'd have testing, so we'd know whether drugs like Meldonium are safe or effective. There's virtually no good studies out there. You'd have things prescribed by a doctor, so athletes would know what safe levels are instead of doing it on their own, where there are some risks. The risks are wildly overstated anyway. Dr. Hoberman talks about strokes and heart attacks, and others talk about cancer. He'd have trouble naming a single elite athlete using steroids, which allegedly cause strokes and heart attacks, who has had a stroke or a heart attack.
This is a big one. We've got Rio and the Olympics coming up. I would love to invite the two of you back to talk it through as we get close to that major, major sporting event. Right now, we've got to let this one go. Dr. Norman Faust at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the bioethics program there. Director, Dr. Faust, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
John Hoberman at the University of Texas, Austin. Hope you'll come again, John. We'll dive further in. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Christopher Clary, Chief Sports Correspondent for the New York Times. Christopher, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
In a moment, for the first time, a top NFL official has acknowledged a link between football-related concussions and chronic brain disease. This is On Point. So yesterday, the NFL's top health and safety officer acknowledged that there is a link between football-related head trauma and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. It's the first time a senior NFL official has publicly acknowledged a connection between football head injuries and the degenerative brain disease, which leads to aggression and dementia and can only be diagnosed after death. Joining me now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Kevin Blackstone. He's a sports columnist at the Washington Post, panelist for ESPN's Around the Horn, professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland. Kevin Blackstone, welcome back to On Point. So great to have you here.
Thanks, John.
How big a deal is this? They were in the middle of a hearing in Washington. The question came. The response came. Yes, there's a connection. Is this an earth shaker?
Well, you ever read somebody's bio line on their Twitter account that says, these tweets are my tweets and not reflective of my employer? Well, the NFL today kind of immediately reacted to what came out of that hearing, because they came out with a statement trying to distance themselves and Jeff Miller from the comments that he actually made yesterday.
You're kidding me. Already?
Well, yeah, and suggest that he was really speaking about Dr. McKee's research and not necessarily about the NFL. Clearly, the NFL does not want to make a link between their game and CTE, despite the work by Dr. McKee and Dr. Cantu and the doctor who's featured in the film Concussions, because that would be guilt. This is a big deal. The NFL has done a marvelous job ever since we started talking about concussions, saying that their game really doesn't have much to do with it.
That's unbelievable. Jeff Miller must be in some kind of NFL hot seat today, his employer. I mean, let me just play it. We report, you decide, listeners. Here it is, the Energy and Commerce Committee yesterday in Washington, Capitol Hill, and this was Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky asking Jeff Miller, the NFL's senior vice president for health and safety, if the link between football and neurodegenerative diseases has been established.
Do you think there is a link between football and degenerative brain disorders like CTE?
Well, certainly Dr. McKee's research shows that a number of retired NFL players were diagnosed with CTE. So the answer to that question is certainly yes.
The answer is most certainly yes. I don't get the wiggle room there, Kevin.
Well, Brian McCarthy, the spokesperson for the NFL, came out in a statement and says that, quote, he was discussing Dr. McKee's findings and made the additional point that a lot more questions need to be answered. He said that the experts should speak to the state of the science. So they are trying to clean up Jeff Miller's statement. And you got to wonder if Jeff Miller, after saying what he said, and then he tried to explain it later on in the hearings, didn't have one of those Southwest Airlines moments where he wished he could get away.
Yeah.
But he can't, and his words are out there forever now.
So interpret the NFL backpedaling so quickly. I mean, at this point, everybody kind of just understands what's going on here. Is it legal liability? Is it something to do with the players' union? Is it because they're afraid people, parents will indeed start turning their kids away in greater numbers from the sport itself?
Well, yeah, I think it's all of that, Tom. I mean, this news comes on the heels of reporting that the Ivy League was not going to do tackling anymore.
In practice.
Try and reduce injuries. It comes on the heels of a Pop Warner lawsuit settlement just the other day where the family of a young man who suffers from CTE in his 20s, sued Pop Warner to say that that's where his concussion started and that they were somehow culpable. This comes on the heels of a lawsuit by several players like Tony Dorsett, the great running back, who is suffering from early signs of maybe having CTE.
Yep.
Against the Rydell Football Company, which used to be one of the iconic brands in terms of cleats and helmets in the league. So this all is under that dark cloud that is hanging over a sport that I love more than anything else, tackle football.
I mean,
it's just time that the NFL, as have college football people and people who run high school football and youth leagues, accept the damage that is being done and figure out even more quickly than they've tried to before how to lasso it and bring it under control.
If we roll the tape back, I mean, I don't know about you, but I cannot imagine old days of football practice without tackling. But roll the tape forward. Do we have just a viability problem here for the NFL, that stadia full of people are going to be sitting there knowing full well, if they fully concede this, that all those players are down there putting their lives at risk, and that's not sustainable? Or can they change professional football further in some way that would keep the sport, keep the excitement, and take away the concussion risk?
Well, my enthusiasm for football has certainly turned into a cringe-worthy endeavor now. I mean, I love football, and I watch it, and I cover it, and I write about it, and I exalt the athletes who are in it. But there are times now where I turn away from it because of the violence in the game. You know, one thing about football, it's been around for a very long time. And if we look back just a little over 100 years ago, there were players dying. There was a player dying basically every weekend in college football until the administration, the Roosevelt administration, Teddy, and the heads of Ivy League football got together and basically started the NCAA and instituted the forward pass to stop the collisions, and some other rules were implemented to kind of cut down on the violence and the damage that it was doing. So, you know, I don't think there's any question that football is at that crossroads again. And how is it going to go forward to be a safer game?
NFL coming as close as you could possibly come to confirming that link. Sounded like confirmation to me. Most certainly, yes. You can't get much clearer than that.
That's right.
I guess we're all implicated at some level. As you say, the cringeworthy part here, sort of new Romans with gladiator sport. Once that is really, really confirmed, and it looks pretty darn clear. Kevin Blackstone, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for jumping in with us for a minute today, Kevin.
Thanks, Tom.
Kevin Blackstone, sports columnist for The Washington Post, and more from ESPN's Around the Horn and more. Listeners, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.